Chapter 26. My new landlady is Mrs. Agnes Klein, and she shows me a room for $12 a week. It's a real room, not like the end of a hall where Mrs. Austin rented me on 68th Street. There's a bed, a desk, a chair, a small couch in the corner by the window, where my brother Michael can sleep when he comes from Ireland in a few months. I'm hardly in the door when Mrs. Klein is telling me her history. She tells me I'm not to jump to any conclusions. Her name might be Klein, but that was her husband, who was Jewish. Her own name is Kenty, and I should know very well you can't get more Irish than that. And if I have no place to go at Christmas, I can spend it with her and her son Michael, what's left of him. Her husband Eddie was the cause of all her troubles. Just before the war, he ran off to Germany with her four-year-old son Michael, because his mother was dying, and he expected to inherit her fortune. Of course they were rounded up, the whole tribe of Kleins, mother and all, and ended up in a camp. No use telling the damn Nazis Michael was an American citizen born in Washington Heights. The husband was never seen again, but Michael survived, and at the end of the war, the poor kid was able to tell the Americans who he was. She tells me what's left of him is in a little room down the hall. She says I should come to her kitchen Christmas Day about 2 p.m. and have a little drink before dinner. There won't be turkey. She'd like to cook European if I don't mind. She tells me don't say yes unless I mean it, that I don't have to come for Christmas dinner if I have some place to go, some Irish girl making mashed potatoes. Don't worry about her. It wouldn't be her first Christmas with no one but Michael at the end of the hall, what's left of him. On Christmas Day, there are strange smells from the kitchen, and there's Mrs. Klein pushing things around in a frying pan. Pierogi, she says. Polish. Michael loves them. Have a vodka with a little orange juice. Good for you this time of year with the flu coming on. We sit in her living room with our drinks, and she talks about her husband. She says we wouldn't be sitting around drinking vodka and cooking up the old pierogies if he were here. For him, Christmas was business as usual. She leans over to adjust a light and her wig falls off, and the vodka in me makes me laugh out loud at the sight of her skull with little tufts of brown hair. Go ahead, she says. Someday your mother's wig will fall off and we'll see if you'll laugh then. And she claps the wig back in her head. I tell her my mother has a fine head of hair, and she says, no wonder. Your mother never had a lunatic husband that walked into the arms of the Nazis, for Christ's sakes. If it wasn't for him, Michael, what's left of him, would be out of that bed there having a vodka with his poor mouth watering for his pierogies. Oh, my God, the pierogies! She jumps from her chair and runs to the kitchen. Well, they're a little burned, but that only makes them nice and crisp. My philosophy is, do you want to know my philosophy? Is whatever goes against you in the kitchen, you can turn it to your advantage. We might as well have another vodka while I cook the sauerkraut and kielbasa. She pours the drinks and barks at me when I ask her what kielbasa is. She says she can't believe the ignorance in the world. 2 years in the U.S. Army and you don't know from kielbasa? No wonder the communists are taking over. It's Polish, for Christ's sake, sausage. And you should watch me fry it in case you marry someone who's not Irish, nice girl who might demand her kielbasa. We stay in the kitchen with another vodka while the kielbasa sizzles and the sauerkraut stews with the vinegar smell. Mrs. Klein puts 3 plates on a tray and pours a glass of manischewitz for Michael, what's left of him. He loves it, she says, loves the manischewitz with the pierogies and kielbasa. I follow her through her bedroom into a small dark room where Michael, what's left of him, sits up in the bed, staring ahead. We bring in chairs and use his bed as a table. Mrs. Klein turns on the radio, and we listen to Oompa Oompa accordion music. That's his favorite music, she says. Anything European. He gets nostalgic, you know. Nostalgic for Europe, for Christ's sakes. Don't you, Michael? Don't you? I'm talking to you. Merry Christmas, Michael. Merry goddamn Christmas. She tears off her wig and throws it into a corner. No more pretending, Michael. I've had it. Talk to me, or next year I cook American. Next year the turkey, Michael, the stuffing, the cranberry sauce, the works, Michael. He stares straight ahead and the kielbasa grease glistens around his plate. His mother fiddles with the radio till she finds Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. Better get used to it, Michael. Next year, Bing and the stuffing. To hell with kielbasa. She pushes her plate aside on the bed and falls asleep with her head by Michael's elbow. I wait a while, take my dinner to the kitchen, dump it into the garbage, return to my room, and fall into my own bed. Timmy Coyne works at Merchant's Refrigerating Company and lives at Mary O'Brien's boarding house at 720 West 180th Street, around the corner from where I live. He tells me, drop in any time for a cup of tea. Mary is that friendly. It's not a real boarding house, it's a big apartment, and there are four boarders, each paying $18 a week. To get a decent breakfast any time they like, not like Logan's in the Bronx, where we had to go to mass or be in a state of grace. Mary herself would rather sit in her kitchen on a Sunday morning drinking tea, smoking cigarettes, and smiling over the boarders and their stories of how they got these desperate hangovers that make them swear, never again. She tells me, I can always move in there if one of the boys leaves to go back to Ireland. They're always going back, she says. They think they can get a few dollars together and settle down on the old farm with some girl from the village. But what do you do night after night with nothing but the wife opposite you, knitting by the light of the fire, and you thinking of the lights of New York, the dance halls on the East Side, and the lovely cozy bars on Third Avenue? I'd like to move into Mary O'Brien's to get away from Mrs. Agnes Klein, who seems to stand forever on the other side of her door, waiting for me to turn the key in the lock so that she can shove a vodka and orange juice into my hand. It doesn't matter to her that I have to read or write papers for my classes at NYU. It doesn't matter that I'm worn out from the midnight shift on the piers or warehouse platforms. She wants to tell me the story of her life, how Eddie charmed her ass off better than any Irishman. And watch out for the Jewish girls, Frank. They can be very charming too, and very, what do you call it? Very sensual. And before you know it, you're stepping on the glass. Stepping on the glass? That's right, Frank. Do you mind if I call you Frank? They won't marry you without you stepping on the wine glass, smashing it. Then they want you to convert so the kids will be Jewish and inherit everything. But I wouldn't. I was going to, but my mother said if I ever turned Jewish, she'd throw herself off the George Washington Bridge. And between you and me, I didn't give a shit if she jumped and bounced off a passing tugboat. She's not the one to stop me from turning Jewish. I kept the faith for my dad, decent man, little problem with the drink, but what could you expect with a name like Canty that's all over the County Kerry, which I expect to see someday if God grants me health? They say the County Kerry is so green and pretty, and I never see green. I see nothing but this apartment and the supermarket, nothing but this apartment and Michael, what's left of him at the end of the hall. My father said it would break his heart if I became Jewish. Not that he had anything against them, poor suffering people, but hadn't we suffered too? And was I going to turn my back on generations of people getting hanged and burned right and left? He came to the wedding, but not my mother. She said what I was doing was putting Christ back up there, suffering on the cross, wounds and all. She said people in Ireland starve to death before they take the Protestant soup. And what would they say about my behavior? Eddie held me in his arms and told me he had trouble with his family too. Told me when you love someone you can tell the whole world kiss your ass. And look what happened to Eddie. Wound up in a goddamn oven. God forgive the language. She sits on my bed, puts her glass on the floor, covers her face with her hands. Jesus, Jesus, she says. I can't sleep thinking what they did to him and what did Michael see. What did Michael see? I saw the pictures in the papers. Jesus. And I know them. The Germans. They live here. They have delicatessens and children. And I ask them, did you kill my Eddie? And they look at me. She cries, lies back in my bed and falls asleep. And I don't know if I should wake her and tell her I'm worn out myself, that I'm paying $12 a week, so that she can fall asleep in my bed, while I try to sleep on the hard couch in the corner, which is waiting for my brother Michael, coming here in a few months. I tell this to Mary O'Brien and her boarders, and they get hysterical laughing. Mary says, Ah, God love her. I know poor Agnes and all belonging to her. There are days she loses her wits entirely and wanders the neighborhood without her wig, asking everyone, where's the rabbi, so that she can convert for the sake of her son, poor Michael, in the bed, what's left of him. Every fortnight, two nuns come to help Mrs. Klein. They wash Michael, what's left of him, and change his sheets. They clean the apartment and watch over her while she takes a bath. They brush her wig so that it doesn't have that tangled look. She doesn't know it, but they weaken her vodka with water. And if she gets drunk at all in her head... Sister Mary Thomas is curious about me. Do I practice my religion? And what school do I go to? Because she sees books and notebooks. When I tell her NYU, she frowns and wonders if I'm not worried about losing my religion in such a place. I can't tell her I stopped going to Mass years ago. She and Sister Beatrice are so good to Mrs. Klein and Michael in the bed, what's left of him. Sister Mary Thomas whispers to me something I'm never to tell another soul, unless it's a priest, that she took the liberty of baptizing Michael. After all, he's not really Jewish, since his mother is Irish Catholic, and Sister would hate to think what might happen to Michael if he died without the sacrament. Didn't he suffer enough in Germany? Little boy looking at his father being laid off or worse. And doesn't he deserve the purification of baptism in case he doesn't wake up some morning in there in the bed? She wants to know now what my situation is here. Am I encouraging Agnes to drink or is it vice versa? I tell her I don't have time for anything. I'm so busy with school and work and trying to sleep a little. She wants to know if I do her a little favor, something to ease her soul. If I have a moment... and poor Agnes is sleeping or passed out with the watery vodka, would I go down the hall, kneel by Michael's bed and say a few Hail Marys, maybe a decade of the rosary? He might not understand, but you never know. With God's help, the Hail Marys might sink into his poor, troubled brain and help him to return to the realm of the living, back to the true faith which came down to him and his mother's side. If I do that, she'll pray for me. Above all, she'll pray that I leave NYU, which everyone knows is a hotbed of communism, where I'm in great danger of losing my immortal soul. And what doth it profit a man if he gain the world and lose his immortal soul? God knows there must be a place for me at Fordham or St. John's, which are not hotbeds of atheistic communism like NYU. I'd be better off out of NYU before Senator McCarthy goes after it, God bless him and keep him. Isn't that right, Sister Beatrice? The other nun nods yes, because she's always so busy, she rarely speaks. While Sister Mary Thomas tries to save my soul from atheistic communism, Sister Beatrice is giving Mrs. Klein a bath, or cleaning Michael what's left of him. Sometimes when Sister Beatrice opens Michael's door, the smell that drifts up the hall is enough to make you sick, but that doesn't stop her from going in. She still washes him and changes his bedclothes, and you can hear her humming hymns. If Mrs. Klein has drunk too much and gets cranky over having to take a bath, Sister Beatrice holds her, hums her hymns, and strokes the little brown tufts on her skull till Mrs. Klein is a child in her arms. That makes Sister Mary Thomas impatient, and she tells Mrs. Klein, "You have no right to waste our time like this. We have other poor souls to visit. Catholics, Mrs. Klein, Catholics." Mrs. Klein whimpers, "I'm a Catholic, I'm a Catholic." "That's debatable, Mrs. Klein." And if Mrs. Klein sobs, Sister Beatrice holds her harder, presses her whole open hand on her head, and hums away with a little smile towards heaven. Sister Mary Thomas waggles her finger at me and tells me, "Beware of marrying outside the true faith. This is what happens." Chapter 27. There's a letter telling me report to my faculty advisor in the English department, Mr. Max Bogart. He says my grades are unsatisfactory, B- in the History of American Education and C in Introduction to Literature. I'm supposed to maintain a B average on my year's probation if I want to stay in college. After all, he says, the dean did you a favor letting you in without a high school diploma, and now you let her down. I have to work. What do you mean you have to work? Everyone has to work. I have to work nights, sometimes days, on piers and warehouses. He says I have to make a decision, work or college. He'll give me a break this time and put me on probation on top of the probation I already have. Next June, he wants to see me with a straight B average or better. I never thought college would be all numbers and letters and grades and averages and people putting me on probation. I thought this would be a place where kindly, learned men and women would teach in a warm way, and if I didn't understand, they'd pause and explain. I didn't know I'd go from course to course with dozens of students, sometimes over 100, with professors lecturing and not even looking at you. Some professors look out the window or up at the ceiling, and some stick their noses in notebooks and read from paper that's yellow and crumbling with age. If students ask questions, they're waved away. In English novels, students at Oxford and Cambridge were always meeting in professors' rooms and sipping sherry while discussing Sophocles. I'd like to discuss Sophocles too, but I'd have to read him first, and there's no time after my nights at Merchant's Refrigeration. And if I'm to discuss Sophocles and get gloomy over existentialism and the Camus suicide problem, I'll have to give up Merchant's Refrigeration. If I didn't have the night job, I might be able to sit in the cafeteria and talk about Pierre or the ambiguities, or Crime and Punishment, or Shakespeare in general. There are girls in the cafeteria with names like Rachel and Naomi, and they're the ones Mrs. Klein told me about, Jewish girls who are very sensual. I wish I had the courage to talk to them, because they're probably like Protestant girls, all in a state of despair over the emptiness of it all, no sense of sin, and ready for all kinds of sensuality. In the spring of 1954, I'm a full-time student at NYU, working only part-time on the docks and the warehouses, or when the manpower agency sends me on a temporary job. The first one is at a hat factory on 7th Avenue, where the owner, Mr. Meyer, tells me it's easy work. All I have to do is take these women's hats, neutral colors all of them, dip these feathers into different dye pots, let the feather dry, match the color against the hat, attach feather to hat. Easy, right? Yeah, that's what you think, says Mr. Meyer, but when I let some of my Puerto Rican help try this job, they came up with color combinations that would blind you. These PRs think life is an Easter parade, and it ain't. You gotta have taste when you match a feather with a hat. Taste, my friend. Little Jewish ladies in Brooklyn don't want to be wearing the Easter parade on their heads and Passover, know what I mean? He tells me I look intelligent enough. College boy, right? Easy job like this shouldn't be a problem. If it is, I shouldn't even be in college. He's going away for a few days, so I'll be on my own, except for the Puerto Rican ladies working on the sewing machines and the cutting tables. Yeah, he says, the PR ladies will take care of you, ha ha. I want to ask him if there are colors that match and colors that don't, but he's gone. I dip feathers into pots, and when I attach them to the hats, the Puerto Rican women and girls start to giggle and laugh. I finish a batch of hats, and they take them to shelves along the walls and bring me another batch. All the time they try not to laugh, but they can't help themselves, and I can't stop blushing. I try to vary the color schemes by dipping the feathers into different pots for a rainbow effect. I use a feather as a paintbrush, and on the other feathers I try to make dots, stripes, sunsets, moons waxing and waning, wavy rivers with fish waggling along and birds roosting, and the women laugh so hard they can't operate the sewing machines. I wish I could talk to them and ask them what I'm doing wrong. I wish I could tell them I wasn't put into this world to stick feathers on hats, that I'm a college student who trained dogs in Germany and worked on the piers. In 3 days, Mr. Meyer returns, and when he sees the hats, he stops inside the door like a man paralyzed. He looks at the women, and they shake their heads as if to say, there's madness in the world. He says, what did you do? And I don't know what to say back. He says, Jesus, I mean, are you Puerto Rican or what? No, sir. Irish, right? Yeah, that's it. Maybe you're colorblind. I didn't ask you about that. Did I ask you about your colorblindness? No, sir. If you're not colorblind, then I don't know how you can explain these combinations. You make the Puerto Ricans look dull, you know that? Dull. I guess it's the Irish thing. No sense of colour. No art, for Christ's sakes. I mean, where are the Irish painters? Name one. I can't. You heard of Van Gogh, right? Rembrandt, Picasso? I did. That's what I mean. You're nice people, the Irish. Great singers, John McCormick. Great cops, politicians, priests. A lot of Irish priests, but no artists. When did you ever see an Irish painting on the wall? A Murphy? A Riley? A Rooney? Nah, kid. I think it's because your people know one color. Green. Right? So, my advice to you is stay away from anything to do with color. Join the cops, run for office, pick up your paycheck and have a nice life. No hard feelings. They shake their heads in the manpower office. They thought this would be the perfect job for me, college boy, right? What's so hard about sticking feathers on hats? Mr. Meyer called them and said, "Don't send me no more Irish college boys. They're colorblind. Send me someone stupid that knows colors and won't mess with my hats." They say if I could type, they'd send me out on all kinds of jobs. I tell them I can't type, that I learned in the army, and I'm powerful. They send me to offices all over Manhattan. From 9 to 5, I sit at desks and type lists, invoices, addresses on envelopes, bills of lading. Supervisors tell me what to do and talk to me only when I make mistakes. The other office workers ignore me because I'm only temporary. A temp, they say. And I might not even be here tomorrow. They don't even see me. I could die at my desk, and they talk past me about what they saw on TV last night, and how they're getting out of here fast Friday afternoon heading for the Jersey Shore. They send out for coffee and pastries, and don't ask me if I have a mouth in my head. Whenever anything unusual happens, it's an excuse for a party. There are presents for people being promoted, getting pregnant, people getting engaged or married. And they'll all stand around the other end of the office drinking wine, eating crackers and cheese for an hour before they go home. Women will bring in their new babies, and all the other women will rush over to tickle them and say, "Isn't she just beautiful? Got your eyes, Miranda, definitely got your eyes." Men will say, "Hi, Miranda, looking good, nice kid." That's all they can say because men are not supposed to be enthusiastic or excited over babies. I'm not invited to the parties, and I feel strange with my typewriter clacking away and everyone having a good time. If a supervisor is giving a small speech, and I'm at the typewriter, they'll call across the office. "Excuse me, you over there, quit the racket a minute, will you? Can't hear ourselves think here." I don't know how they can work in these offices day after day, year in, year out. I can't stop looking at the clock. And there are times I think I'll just get up and walk away the way I did at the Blue Cross Insurance Company. The people in their offices don't seem to mind. They go to the water cooler, they go to the toilet, they walk from desk to desk and chat, they call from desk to desk on the telephone, they admire each other's clothes, hair, makeup, and anytime someone loses a few pounds in a diet. If a woman is told she lost weight, she smiles for an hour and keeps running her hands over her hips. Office people brag about their children, their wives, their husbands, and they dream about the two-week vacation. I'm sent to an import-export firm on 4th Avenue. I'm given a pile of papers that have to do with importing Japanese dolls. I'm supposed to copy this paper to that paper. It's 9:30 a.m. by the office clock. I look out the window. The sun is shining. A man and woman are kissing outside a coffee shop across the avenue. It's 9:33 a.m. by the office clock. The man and woman separate and walk in opposite directions. They turn. They run towards each other to kiss again. It's 9:36 a.m. by the office clock. I take my jacket from the back of the chair and slip it on. The office manager stands at his cubicle door and says, "Hey, what's up?" I don't answer. People are waiting for the elevator, but I head for the stairs and run as fast as I can down 7 flights. The kissing people have disappeared, and I'm sorry. I wanted to see them once more. I hope they're not going to offices where they'll be typing lists of Japanese dolls or telling everyone they're engaged so that the office manager will allow them an hour of wine and cheese. and crackers. With my brother Maliki in the Air Force sending a monthly allotment, my mother is comfortable in Limerick. She has the house with gardens front and back where she can grow flowers and onions if she likes. She has enough money for clothes and bingo and excursions to the seaside at Kilkee. Alfie is in school at the Christian Brothers where he'll get a secondary school education and all kinds of opportunities. With the comfort of the new house, beds, sheets, blankets, pillows, he doesn't have to worry about battling fleas all night. There's DDT. And he doesn't have to struggle to light a fire in the grate every morning. There's the gas stove. He can have an egg every day if he likes, and not even think about it the way we did. He has decent clothes and shoes, and he's warm, no matter how bad it is outside. It's time for me to send for Michael so that he can come to New York and get on in the world. When he arrives, he's so thin I want to take him out and fill him with hamburgers and apple pie. He stays with me a while at Mrs. Klein's and works at different jobs, but there's the threat of being drafted into the army, and he thinks it's better to join the Air Force because the uniform is a nice shade of blue, more glamorous than the shitty brown of the army uniform, and more likely to attract girls. Once Maliki is out of the Air Force, Michael can continue the monthly allotment that will keep my mother going for another 3 years, and I'll have only myself to worry about till I finish at NYU. Chapter 28. When she saunters into the psychology class, the professor himself lets his jaw drop, and he grips a piece of chalk so hard it cracks and breaks. He says, "Excuse me, miss," and she gives him such a smile all he can do is smile back. "Excuse me, miss," he says, "but we're seated alphabetically, and I'd need to know your name." "Alberta Small," she says. And he points to a row behind me, and we don't mind one bit if she takes all day getting to her seat because we're feasting on her blonde hair, blue eyes, luscious lips, a bosom that is an occasion of sin, a figure that makes you throb in the middle of your body. A few rows back, she whispers, "Excuse me," and there's a shuffle and a flutter, where students have to stand to let her get to her seat. I'd like to be one of the students standing to let her by, to have her brush against me and touch me. When the class ends, I want to make sure I let her pass up the aisle so that I can watch her coming and see her going with that figure you see only in films. She passes and gives me a little smile, and I wonder why God is so kind to me that he lets me have a smile from the loveliest girl in all of NYU, so blonde and blue-eyed, she must hail from a tribe of Scandinavian beauties. I wish I could say to her, "Hi, would you like to go for a cup of coffee and a grilled cheese sandwich and discuss existentialism?" But I know that will never happen, especially when I see who's meeting her in the hallway, a student the size of a mountain wearing a jacket that says, "New York University, football." At the next meeting of the psychology class, the professor asked me a question about Jung and the collective unconscious, and the moment I open my mouth, I know everyone is staring at me as if to say, "Who's the one with the Irish brogue?" The professor himself says, "Oh, do I detect an Irish accent?" And I have to admit he does. He tells the class that, of course, the Catholic Church has been traditionally hostile to psychoanalysis. Isn't that right, Mr. McCourt? And I feel he's accusing me. Why is he talking about the Catholic Church just because I tried to answer his question on the collective unconscious? And am I supposed to defend the Church? I don't know, Professor. There's no use telling him that one Redemptorist priest in Limerick ranted from the pulpit on Sunday mornings denouncing Freud and Jung and promising they'd wind up in the deepest hole in hell, the two of them. If I talk in class, I know no one is listening to what I'm saying. They're listening only to my accent, and there are times when I wish I could reach into my mouth and tear my accent out by the roots. Even when I try to sound American, people look puzzled and say, "Do I detect an Irish brogue?" At the end of the class, I wait for the blonde to pass by, but she stops. The blue eyes smile at me, and she says, "Hi," and my heart bangs in my chest. She says, "My name is Mike." "Mike?" "Well, actually, my name is Alberto, but they call me Mike." There's no football player outside, and she says she has 2 hours till her next class. "And would I like to have a drink at Rocky's?" I have a class in 10 minutes, but I'm not going to miss this chance to be with this girl everyone is staring at. This girl who picked me out of all the people in the world to say hello to. We have to walk quickly to Rocky's so that we won't run into Bob, the football player. He might be upset if he knew she was having a drink with another boy. I wonder why she calls all males boy. I'm 23. She says she's kinda engaged to Bob, that they're pinned, and I don't know what she's talking about. She says a girl who's pinned is engaged to be engaged, and you could tell if a girl is pinned when she wears her boyfriend's high school graduation ring on a necklace. It makes me wonder why she's not wearing Bob's ring. She says he gave her a gold bracelet with her name on it to wear around her ankle that would show she's taken, but she doesn't wear it because that's what Puerto Rican girls do and they're too flashy. The bracelet is what you get just before the engagement ring, and she'll wait for that, thank you very much. She tells me she's from Rhode Island. She was reared there from the age of 7 by her father's mother. Her own mother was only 16 when she was born, and her father 20, so you can guess what happened there. Shotgun. When the war came and he was drafted and sent to Seattle, it was the end of the marriage. Even though Mike was a Protestant, she graduated from a Catholic convent school in Fall River, Massachusetts. And she smiles at the memory of that graduation summer when she had a different date nearly every night. She might be smiling, but I feel a great surge of rage and envy, and I'd like to kill the boys who ate popcorn with her and probably kissed her in drive-in movies. Now she's living with her father and stepmother up on Riverside Drive, and her grandmother is here for a while till she settles in and gets used to the city. She's not a bit shy about telling me she likes my Irish accent, and she even liked looking at the back of my head in class, the way my hair is black and wavy. This makes me blush, and even though it's dark in Rockies, she can see the blush, and she thinks it's cute. I have to get used to the way they say cute in New York. If you say someone is cute in Ireland, you're saying he's cunning and sneaky. I'm in Rockies, and I'm in heaven, drinking beer with this girl who could have stepped on from a movie screen, another Virginia Mayo. I know I'm the envy of every man and boy in Rockies, that it'll be the same on the streets, heads turning and wondering who I am, that I'm with the loveliest girl in NYU and Manhattan itself. After 2 hours, she has to go on to her next class. I'm ready to carry her books the way they do in the movies, but she says no. Better that I stay here a while in case we run into Bob, who wouldn't be a bit pleased to see her with the likes of me. She laughs and reminds me, he's big. Thanks for the beer. See you next week in class. And she's gone. Her glass is still on the table. It's marked with pink lipstick. I put it to my lips for the taste of her and dream that someday I'll kiss the lips themselves. I press her glass against my cheek and think of her kissing the football player, and there are dark clouds in my head. Why would she sit with me in Rockies if she's kinda engaged to him? Is that the way it is in America? If you love someone, you're supposed to be loyal to them at all times. If you don't love them, then it's all right to drink beer in Rockies with someone else. If she goes to Rockies with me, then she doesn't love him, and that makes me feel better. Is it that she feels sorry for me with my Irish accent and my red eyes? Is she able to guess that it's hard for me to talk to girls unless they talk to me first? All over America, there are men who walk up to girls and say hi. I could never do that. I'd feel foolish saying hi in the first place because I didn't grow up with it. I'd have to say hello or something grown up. Even when they talk to me, I never know what to say. I don't want them to know I never went to high school, and I don't want them to know I grew up in an Irish slum. I'm so ashamed of the past that all I can do is lie about it. The lecturer in English composition, Mr. Kalitri, would like us to write an essay on a single object from our childhood, an object that had significance for us, something domestic if possible. There isn't an object in my childhood I want anyone to know about. I wouldn't want Mr. Kalitri or anyone in the class to know about the slum lavatory we shared with all those families in Roden Lane. I could make up something, but I can't think of anything like the things other students talk about. The family car, Dad's old baseball mitt, the sled they had so much fun with, the old icebox, the kitchen table where they did their homework. All I can think of is the bed I shared with my three brothers, and even though I'm ashamed of it, I have to write about it. If I make up something that's nice and respectable and don't write about the bed, I'll be tormented. Besides, Mr. Kalitri will be the only one reading it, and I'll be safe. The bed. When I was growing up in Limerick, my mother had to go to the St. Vincent de Paul Society to see if she could get a bed for me and my brothers, Malachy, Michael and Alfie, who was barely walking. The man at the St. Vincent de Paul said he could give her a docket to go down to Irishtown to a place that sold second-hand beds. My mother asked him, couldn't we get a new bed? Because you never know what you're getting with an old one. There could be all kinds of diseases. The man said, beggars can't be choosers, and my mother shouldn't be so particular, but she wouldn't give up. She asked if it was possible at least to find out if anyone had died in the bed. Surely that wasn't asking too much. She wouldn't want to be lying in her own bed at night thinking about her four small sons sleeping on a mattress that someone had died on, maybe someone that had a fever or consumption. The St. Vincent de Paul man said, Mrs., if you don't want this bed, give me back the docket and I'll give it to someone that's not so particular. Ma'am said, I know. And she came home to get Alfie's pram so we could carry the mattress, the spring, and the bedstead. The man in the shop in the Irish town wanted her to take a mattress with hair sticking out and spots and stains all over, but my mother said she wouldn't let a cow sleep in a bed like that. Didn't the man have another mattress over there in the corner? The man grumbled and said, all right, all right, be Jesus, the charity cases are getting very particular these days. And he stayed behind his counter, watching us drag the mattress outside. We had to push the pram up and down the streets of Limerick three times for the mattress and the different parts of the iron bedstead, the head, the end, the supports, and the spring. My mother said she was ashamed of her life and wished she could do this at night. The man said he was sorry for her troubles, but he closed the six sharp and wouldn't stay up if the Holy Family came for a bed. It was hard pushing the pram because it had one buckety wheel that wanted to go its own way, and it was harder still with Alfie buried under the mattress screaming for his mother. My father was there to drag the mattress upstairs, and he helped us put the spring and the bedstead together. Of course, he wouldn't help us push the pram 2 miles from the Irish town because he'd be ashamed of the spectacle. He was from the north of Ireland, and they must have a different way of bringing home the bed. We had old overcoats to put on the bed, because the St. Vincent de Paul Society wouldn't give us a docket for sheets and blankets. My mother lit the fire, and when we sat around it drinking tea, she said, at least we're all off the floor, and isn't God good? The next week, Mr. Kalitri sits on the edge of his desk on the platform. He pulls our essays from his bag and tells the class, not a bad set of essays, some a little too sentimental, but there's one I'd like to read to you if the author doesn't mind. The bed. He looks towards me and lets his eyebrows go up as if to say, do you mind? I don't know what to say, though I'd like to tell him, no, no, please don't tell the world what I came from. But the heat is in my face already, and I can only shrug to him as if I don't care. He reads the bed. And I can feel the whole class looking at me and I'm ashamed. I'm glad Mike Small isn't in this class. She'd never look at me again. There are girls in the class, and they're probably thinking they should move away from me. I want to tell them this is a made-up story, but Mr. Kalitri is up there talking about it now, telling the class why he gave it an A, that my style is direct, my subject matter, rich. He laughs when he says rich. Do you know what I mean, he says. He tells me I should continue to explore my rich past, and he smiles again. I don't know what he's talking about, I'm sorry I ever wrote about that bed, and I'm afraid everyone would pity me and treat me like a charity case. The next time I have to take a class in English composition, I put my family in a comfortable house in the suburbs, and I'll make my father a postman with a pension. At the end of the class, students nod to me and smile, and I wonder if they're already feeling sorry for me. Mike Small came from another world, she and her football player. They might be from different parts of America, but they were teenagers, and it was the same all over. They went on dates on Saturday nights, where the boy would have to meet the girl at her house. And of course, she'd never be at the door waiting for him, because that would show she was too eager. And word would get around, and she'd be alone every Saturday night the rest of her life. The boy would have to wait in the living room with a silent dad, who always looked disapproving behind his newspaper, knowing what he did on dates in the old days himself, and wondering what was going to be done to his little daughter. The mother would fuss and want to know what movie they were going to and what time they'd be home, because her daughter was a nice girl who needed a good night's sleep to keep that glow in her complexion for church tomorrow morning. At the movies they held hands, and if the boy was lucky he might get a kiss and accidentally touch her breast. If that happened, she'd give him a sharp look, and that meant the body was being reserved for the honeymoon. After the movie, they'd have hamburgers and milkshakes at the soda fountain with all the other high school kids, the boys in crew cuts, and the girls in skirts and bobby socks. They'd sing along with the jukebox, and the girls would squeal over Frankie. If the girl liked the boy, she might let him have a long kiss at her door. Maybe one dart of a tongue in the mouth, but if he tried to keep the tongue in there, she'd back away and tell him good night. She had a nice time, thank you. And that was another reminder the body was being reserved for the honeymoon. Some girls would let you touch and feel and kiss, but they wouldn't let you go all the way, and they were known as 90%ers. There was some hope for 90%ers, but the all-the-way girls had such a reputation, no one in town would want to marry them. And they were the ones who would pack up one day and go to New York, where everyone does everything. This is what I saw in the movies, or what I heard in the army from GIs who came from all over the country. If you had a car and a girl said yes, she'd go with you to a drive-in movie. You knew she was expecting more than popcorn and the doings up there on the screen. There was no sense in just going for a kiss. You could get that in a regular movie house. The drive-in was where you got the tongue into the mouth and the hand on the breast. And if she let you get the nipple, man, she was yours. The nipple was like a key that opened the legs. And if you weren't with another couple, it was into the back seat, and who cared about the goddamn movie? The GI said there were funny nights when you might be making out, but your friend was having trouble in the back seat with his girl who was sitting up and watching the movie. Or it might be vice versa, where your buddy is making out and you're so frustrated you want to explode in your pants. Sometimes your buddy might be finished with his girl and she's ready to take you on, and that's pure heaven, man. Because not only are you getting laid, the one who rejected you is sitting there stone-faced, pretending to watch the movie, but really listening to you back there. And sometimes she can't stand it anymore and climbs on you, and you're caught between two broads in the backseat. God damn. Men in the army said you'd have no respect later for the girl who let you go all the way, and you'd have only a little respect for the 90%er. Of course you'd have complete respect for the girl who said no and sat up watching the movie. That's the girl that was pure, not damaged goods, and the girl you'd want to be the mother of your children. If you married a girl who fooled around, how would you ever know you were the real father of your kids? I know that if Mike Small ever went to a drive-in, she was the one who sat up and watched the movie. Anything else would be too much of a pain to think about, especially when it's hard to think of her even kissing the football player at her own door with her father inside waiting. The nuns tell me Mrs. Klein is losing her wits with the drink and neglecting poor Michael, what's left of him. They're moving them to places where they can be cared for, Catholic homes. Though it's better not to tell anyone about Michael for fear some Jewish organization would claim him. Sister Mary Thomas is not against the Jews, but she doesn't want to lose a precious soul like Michael's. One of Mary O'Brien's boarders is going back to Ireland to settle on his father's 5 acres and marry a girl from down the road. I can have his bed for $18 a week and help myself in the morning to whatever is in the fridge. The other Irish boarders work in the piers and warehouses, and they bring home canned fruits or bottles of rum and whiskey from cases that accidentally fell when ships were being unloaded. Mary says, "Isn't it wonderful that when you say there's something you'd like, a whole case of it is accidentally dropped the next day on the docks?" There are Sunday mornings we don't bother cooking breakfast. We're that happy in the kitchen with slices of pineapple and heavy syrup, and glasses of rum to wash it down. Mary reminds us about Mass, but we're content enough with our pineapple and rum, and soon Timmy Coyne is calling for a song even if it's a Sunday morning. He works in Merchant's Refrigeration and often brings home a great side of beef on Friday nights. He's the only one who cares about going to Mass, though he makes sure he's back in no time for the pineapple and rum, which can't last forever. Frankie and Danny Lennon are twins, Irish-Americans. Frankie lives in another apartment and Danny is a boarder with Mary. Their father, John, lives on the streets, wanders around with a pint of wine in a brown paper bag, and cleans Mary's apartment in exchange for a shower, sandwich, and a few drinks. His sons laugh and sing, "Oh, my papa, to me he was so wonderful." Frankie and Danny take classes at City College, one of the best colleges in the country, and free. Even though they're studying accounting, they're always excited over their courses in literature. Frankie talks about seeing a girl in the subway reading James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and how anxious he was to sit beside her and discuss Joyce. All the way from 34th Street to 181st Street, he would leave his seat and move towards her, never having the courage to talk to her, and losing his seat each time to another passenger. At last, when the train pulled into 181st Street, he bent to her and said, "Great book, isn't it?" And she jerked back from him and let out a cry. He wanted to tell her, "Sorry, sorry," but the doors were closing, and he was out on the platform with people in the train glaring at him. They love jazz, and they're like two mad professors in the living room, putting records on the phonograph, clicking their fingers to the beat, telling me all about the great musicians on this Benny Goodman record, Gene Krupa, Harry James, Lionel Hampton, Benny himself. They tell me this was the greatest jazz concert of all time, and the first time a black man was allowed on the Carnegie Hall stage. And listen to him. Listen to Lionel Hampton all velvet and glide. Listen to him and Benny coming in. Listen, and here comes Harry sending in a few notes to tell you, "Watch out, I'm flying," and Krupa going bap 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 de doo bap 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 bap, hands feet going sing sing sing, and the whole damn band wild man wild, and the audience listen to that audience out of their mind, man, out of their ever loving mind. They play Count Basie, point their fingers, and laugh when the count hits those single notes. And when they play Duke Ellington, they're all over the living room, clicking fingers and stopping to tell me, "Listen, listen to this." And I listen because I never listened like this before, and now I hear what I never heard before, and I have to laugh with the Lennons when the musicians take passages from tunes and turn them upside down and inside out and put them back again as if to say, "Look, we borrowed your little tune a while to play our own way, but don't worry, here it's back again, and you go hum it, honey, you sing that, mother man." The Irish boarders complain this is just a lot of noise. Paddy Arthur says, "Sure you're not Irish at all with all that stuff. What about some Irish songs in that machine? What about a few Irish dance tunes?" The Lennons laugh and tell us their father left the bogs a long time ago. Danny says, "This is American, man, this is the music." But Paddy Arthur pulls Duke Ellington off the phonograph and puts on Frank Lee's Tara Cayley Band, and we sit around the living room, listening, tapping slightly, and not moving our faces. The Lennons laugh and leave. Chapter 29. Sister Mary Thomas somehow found my new address and sent me a note to say it would be very nice if I came over and said goodbye to Mrs. Klein and Michael, what's left of him, and to pick up two books I'd left under my bed. There's an ambulance waiting outside the apartment house, and upstairs, Sister Mary Thomas is telling Mrs. Klein she has to put on a wig, and no, she can't have a rabbi. They don't have rabbis where she's going, and she'd be better off on her knees saying a decade of the rosary and praying for forgiveness. And down the hall, Sister Beatrice is crooning to Michael what's left of him and telling him a brighter day is dawning, that where he's going there would be birds and flowers and trees and a risen Lord. Sister Mary Thomas calls down the hall. Sister, you're wasting your time. He doesn't understand the word you're saying. But Sister Beatrice answers back, it doesn't matter, sister. He's a child of the Lord, a Jewish child of the Lord, sister. He's not Jewish, sister. Does it matter, sister? Does it matter? It matters, sister. And I advise you to consult your confessor. Yes, sister, I will. And Sister Beatrice goes on with her cheerful words and hymns to Michael, what's left of him, who may or may not be Jewish. Sister Mary Thomas says, oh, I nearly forgot your books. They're under the bed. She hands me the books and rubs her hands together as if to clean them. Don't you know, she says, that Anatole France is on the index of the Catholic Church, and D.H. Lawrence was a completely depraved Englishman who is now howling in the depths of hell, the Lord save us all. If that's what you're reading at New York University, I fear for your soul, and I light a candle for you. No, sister, I'm reading Penguin Island for myself and Women in Love for one of my classes. She rolls her eyes to heaven. Oh, the arrogance of youth. I feel sorry for your poor mother. There are two men in white coats at the door with a stretcher, and they go down the hall for Michael, what's left of him. Mrs. Klein sees them and calls, Rabbi, Rabbi, help me in my hour, and Sister Mary Thomas pushes her back into her chair. They shuffle back down the hall, men in white, with Michael, what's left of him, on the stretcher, and Sister Beatrice stroking the top of his head that looks like a skull. Alana, Alana, she says in her Irish accent, sure there's nothing left of you, but you'll see the sky now and the clouds in it. She goes down with him in the elevator, and I'd like to go myself to get away from Sister Mary Thomas and her remarks on the state of my soul and the terrible things I'm reading, but I have to say goodbye to Mrs. Klein, all dressed up in her wig and hat. She takes my hand. Take care of Michael, what's left of him, won't you, Eddie? Eddie. I feel a fierce pain in my heart because of this, and a terrible memory of Rappaport and the laundry at Dachau. And I wonder if I'll ever know anything in the world but darkness. Will I ever know what Sister Beatrice promised Michael, what's left of him? Birds, flowers, trees, and a risen Lord. What I learned in the army comes in useful at NYU. Never raise your hand. Never let them know your name. Never volunteer. Students just graduated from high school, 18 years of age, raise their hands regularly to tell the class and the professor what they think. If professors look directly at me and ask questions, I can never finish the answers with the way they always say, oh, do I detect a brogue? After that, I have no peace. Whenever an Irish writer is mentioned, or anything Irish, everyone turns to me as if I am the authority. Even the professors seem to think I know all about Irish literature and history. If they say anything about Joyce or Yeats, they look at me as if I'm the expert, as if I should nod and confirm what they say. I nod all the time because I don't know what else to do. If ever I shook my head in doubt or disagreement, the professors would dig deeper with their questions and expose my ignorance for all to see, especially the girls. It's the same with Catholicism. If I answer a question, they hear my accent, and that means I'm a Catholic and ready to defend Mother Church to the last drop of my blood. Some professors like to taunt me by sneering at the Virgin Birth, the Holy Trinity, the celibacy of St. Joseph, the Inquisition, the priest-ridden people of Ireland. When they talk like that, I don't know what to say because they have the power to lower my grade and damage my average so that I won't be able to follow the American dream. and that might drive me to Albert Camus and the daily decision not to commit suicide. I fear professors with their high degrees, and the way they might make me look foolish before the other students, especially the girls. I'd like to stand up in those classes and announce to the world that I'm too busy to be Irish or Catholic or anything else, that I'm working day and night to make a living, trying to read books for my courses and falling asleep in the library, trying to write term papers with footnotes and bibliographies on a typewriter that betrays me with the letters A and J, so that I have to go back and retype whole pages since it's impossible to avoid A and J, falling asleep on subway trains all the way to the last stop, so that I'm embarrassed I have to ask people where I am when I don't even know what borough I'm in. If I didn't have red eyes and an Irish accent, I could be purely American, and I wouldn't have to put up with professors tormenting me with Yeats and Joyce and the Irish literary renaissance and how clever and witty the Irish are, and what a beautiful green country it is, though priest-ridden and poor, with a population ready to vanish from the face of the earth due to puritanical sexual repression. And what do you have to say to that, Mr. McCord? I think you're right, Professor. Oh, he thinks I'm right. And Mr. Katz, what do you say to that? I guess I agree, Professor. I don't know too many Irish. Ladies and gentlemen, you must consider what has just been said by Mr. McCourt and Mr. Katz. Here we have the intersection of the Celtic and the Hebraic, both ready to accommodate and compromise. Isn't that right, Mr. McCourt, Mr. Katz? We nod, and I remember what my mother used to say. A nod is as good as a wink to a blind horse. I'd like to say this to the professor, but I can't take the risk of offending him with all the power he has to keep me from the American dream and make me look foolish before the class, especially the girls. Monday and Wednesday mornings in the fall term, Professor Middlebrook teaches the literature of England. She mounts the little platform, sits, places the heavy textbook on the desk, reads from it, comments, and looks at the class only to ask an occasional question. She starts with Beowulf and ends with John Milton, who, she says, is sublime, somewhat in disfavor in our time, but his day will come, his day will come. Students read newspapers, work at crossword puzzles, pass notes to each other, study for other courses. After my all-night shifts at various jobs, it's hard to stay awake, and when she asks me a question, Brian McPhillips jabs me with his elbow, whispers the question and the answer, and I stammer it back to her. Sometimes she mutters into the textbook, and I know I'm in trouble, and that trouble takes the form of a C at the end of the term. With all my latenesses and absences and falling asleep in class, I know I deserve a C, and I'd like to tell the professor how guilty I feel, and if she failed me completely, I wouldn't blame her. I'd like to explain that even if I'm not a model student, she should see the way I am with the Literature of England textbook, all excited reading it in the NYU library, on subway trains, even on piers and warehouse platforms during lunch hour. She should know I'm probably the only student in the world who ever got into trouble with men on warehouse platforms over a literature book. The men would taunt me. "Hey, look at the college boy. Too good to talk to us, eh?" And when I told them about the strangeness of the Anglo-Saxon language, they'd tell me I was full of shit. That wasn't English at all, and who the fuck do you think you're kidding, kid? Maybe they never went to college, they said, but they weren't going to have the wool pulled over their eyes by a half-assed shithead just off the boat from Ireland, telling them this was the English language when you could see there wasn't an English word on the whole goddamn page. After that, they won't talk to me, and the platform boss shifts me inside to run the elevator so that the men won't be pulling tricks on me, dropping loads to jerk the arms out of my sockets or pretending to run me down with forklift trucks. I'd like to tell the professor how I look at the authors and poets in the textbook and ask myself which of them I'd like to have a pint with in a Greenwich Village pub, and the one that stands out is Chaucer. I'd buy him a pint any time and listen to his stories about the Canterbury Pilgrims. I'd like to tell the professor how much I love the sermons of John Donne, and how I'd like to buy him a pint, except that he was a Protestant priest and not known for sitting in taverns knocking back the pint. I can't talk about this, because it's dangerous to raise your hand in any class to say how much you love anything. The professor will look at you with a pitying little smile, and the class will see that, and the pitying little smile will travel around the room till you feel so foolish the face turns red, and you promise you'll never love anything in college again, or if you do, keep it to yourself. I can say this to Brian McPhillip sitting next to me, but someone in the seat before me turns and says, "Aren't we being a little paranoid?" Paranoid? That's another word I have to look up with the way everyone at NYU uses it. From the way this student looks at me with his superior left eyebrow nearly up to his hairline, I can only guess he's accusing me of being demented. And there's no use trying to answer him till I find out what that word means. I'm sure Brian McPhillips knows what that word means, but he's busy talking to Joyce Timpanelli on his left. They're always looking at each other and smiling. That means there's something going on, and I can't bother them with the word paranoid. I should carry a dictionary, and when anyone throws a strange word at me, I could look it up on the spot and shoot back with a smart answer that would collapse the superior eyebrow. Or I could practice the silence I learned in the army and go my own way, which is the best thing of all, because people who torment other people with strange words don't like it when you go your own way. Andy Peters sits next to me in Introduction to Philosophy and tells me about a job in a bank, Manufacturers Trust Company down on Broad Street. They're looking for people to work with personal loan applications, and I could choose a 4 to midnight shift or a midnight to 8 a.m. He says, the best thing about this job is, once you finish the work, you can leave, that no one works the full 8 hours. There's a typing test. I have no trouble with that because of the way the army dragged me away from my dog and made me a company clerk typist. The bank says, okay, I can work the 4 to midnight shift so that I can take my classes in the morning and sleep at night. Wednesdays and Fridays, I have no classes, and I can shape up the warehouses and piers and make extra money against the day my brother Michael is out of the Air Force and the allotment to my mother ends. I can put the Wednesday-Friday money in a separate account, and when the time comes, she won't have to be running to the St. Vincent de Paul Society for food or shoes. There are 7 women and 4 men on the shift at the bank, and all we have to do is take piles of applications for personal loans and send the notices to the applicants that they've been accepted or rejected. Andy Peters tells me during a coffee break that if I ever see an application from a friend that's been rejected, I can change it to acceptance. There's a little code the daytime loan officers use, and he'll show me how to alter it. Night after night, we see hundreds of applications for loans. People want them for new babies, vacations, cars, furniture, consolidation of debts, hospital expenses, funerals, decorating apartments. Sometimes there are letters attached, and if there's a good one, we all stop typing and read them back and forth. There are letters that make the women cry, and the men want to cry. Babies die, and there are expenses, and would the bank help? A husband runs away, and the applicant doesn't know what to do, where to turn. She never had a job in her life. How could she with raising 3 kids, and she needs $300 to tide her over till she finds work and a cheap babysitter? One man promises that if the bank loans him $500, they can take a pint of his blood every month for the rest of his life, and it's a good deal, he says, because he has a rare blood type, which he's not ready to divulge at this moment, but if the bank helps him out, they're getting blood that's as good as gold, the best collateral in the world. The blood man is rejected, and Andy lets it pass. But he changes the code for the desperate woman with the 3 kids, who was rejected for having no collateral. Andy says, I don't understand how they can give loans to people who want to spend 2 weeks lying in the sand at the goddamn Jersey Shore and then turn down a woman with 3 kids hanging on by her fingernails. This, my friend, is where the revolution starts. He changes a few applications every night to prove how stupid a bank can be. He says he knows what happens during the day when asshole loan people go through the applications. Harlem address, Negro, points off, Puerto Rican, mucha points off. He tells me there are dozens of Puerto Ricans around New York who think they were accepted for their good credit, but it was Andy Peters all the time feeling sorry for them. He says it's a big thing in PR neighborhoods to get out there on the weekend and polish the car. They might never go anywhere, but it's the polishing that matters. Old guys on the stoop watching the polishing and drinking the old cerveza from bodegas in quart bottles. The radio blasting away with Tito Puentes. The old guys checking out the girls, shaking their asses along the sidewalks. Man, that's living, man. That's living. And what more do you want? Andy talks about Puerto Ricans all the time. He says they're the only people who know how to live in this goddamn tight-ass city. That it's a tragedy the Spaniards didn't sail up the Hudson instead of the goddamn Dutch and the goddamn Limeys. We'd have siestas, man. We'd have color. We wouldn't have the man in the gray flannel suit. If he had his way, he'd give a loan to every Puerto Rican applying for a car loan, so that all over the city you'd have them polishing their new cars, drinking their beer out of brown paper bags, digging Tito, and flirting with the girls, shaking their asses along the sidewalks, girls with those see-through peasant blouses and Jesus medallions nestling in their cleavage, and wouldn't that be a city to live in? The women in the office laugh at the way Andy talks, but they tell him be quiet because they want to finish the work and get out of here. They have kids at home and husbands waiting. When we finish early, we go for a beer, and he tells me why he's a 31-year-old student studying philosophy at New York University. He was in the war, not Korea, the big one in Europe, but he has to work nights in this goddamn bank because of his dishonorable discharge in the spring of 1945, just before the war ended, and isn't that a bitch? Taking a shit, that's what he was, a nice, quiet shit in a French ditch. All wiped and ready to button up, when who comes along but a goddamn lieutenant and a sergeant, and the lieutenant has nothing else to do but march up to Andy and accuse him of an unnatural act with that sheep standing there a few feet away. Andy admits that in a way, the lieutenant had a right to jump to the wrong conclusion, since just before pulling up his pants, Andy had a hard-on which made it difficult to pull up the aforesaid pants. And even though he hated anything in the shape of an officer, he felt an explanation would help. Well, Lieutenant, I may have fucked that sheep, or I may not have fucked that sheep, but what's interesting here is your peculiar concern with me and my relationship with that sheep. There's a war on, Lieutenant. I come out here to take a shit in a French ditch, and there's a sheep at eye level, and I'm 19 years old, and I haven't been laid since my high school prom, and a sheep, especially a French sheep, looks very tempting. And if I look like I was ready to jump on that sheep, you're right, Lieutenant, I was, but I didn't. You and the sergeant interrupted a beautiful relationship. I thought the lieutenant would laugh. Instead, he said I was a goddamn liar, that I had sheep written all over me. I wanted sheep all over me. I dreamed of it, but it hadn't happened, and what he said was so unfair, I pushed him. Didn't hit him, just pushed. And the next thing, Jesus, they had all kinds of artillery sticking in my face. Pistols, carbines, M1 rifles, and before you know it, there was a court-martial where I had a drunken captain defending me, who told me in private that I was a disgusting sheepfucker, and he was sorry he couldn't be at the other end prosecuting me because his father was a Basque from Montana, where they respected their sheep, and I still don't know if I was sent to the stockade for 6 months for assaulting an officer or screwing a sheep. What I got out of it was a dishonorable discharge, and when that happens, you might as well study philosophy at NYU. Chapter 30. Because of Mr. Kilitri, I scribble memories of Limerick in notebooks. I make lists of streets, schoolmasters, priests, neighbors, friends, shops. After the bed essay, I'm sure people in Mr. Kilitri's class are looking at me in a different way. The girls are probably telling each other they'd never go out with someone who spent his life in a bed a man might have died in. Then Mike Small tells me she heard about the essay and how it moved so many people in the class, boys and girls. I didn't want her to know where I came from, but now she wants to read the essay, and afterwards her eyes fill up and she says, "Oh, I never knew. Oh, it must have been awful." It reminds her of Dickens, though I don't know how that can be, because everything in Dickens always ends happily. No matter what misfortunes his heroes suffer, there's always a shower of riches at the end, and mysterious strangers at the door to tell them they're the long-lost sons of the Duke of Sussex. Of course I won't say this to Mike Small for fear she might think I'm arguing with her. She might turn on her heel and march back to Bob the football player. Now Mr. Killeatry wants us to write a family essay where there's adversity, a dark moment, a setback. And even though I don't want to go into the past, there's something that happened to my mother that demands to be written. The plot. When the war started and food was rationed in Ireland, the government offered poor families plots of land and fields outside Limerick. Each family could have a 1/16 of an acre, clear it, and grow whatever vegetables they liked. My father applied for a plot out the road in Rossbrien, and the government lent him a spade and a fork for the work. He took my brother Malachy and me to help him. When my brother Michael saw the spade, he cried and wanted to go too, but he was only 4 and he would have been in the way. My father told him wished that when we came back from Rossbrien, we'd bring him berries. I asked my father if I could carry the spade, and I was soon sorry because Rossbrien was miles outside Limerick. Malachy had started out carrying the fork, but my father took it away from him because of the way he was swinging it and nearly knocking people's eyes out. Malachy cried till my father said he'd let him carry the spade all the way home. My brother soon forgot the fork when he saw a dog who was willing to chase a stick for miles till he frothed white stuff with the weariness and lay down on the road looking up with the stick between his paws, and we had to leave him. When my father saw the plot, he shook his head. "Rocks," he said. "Rocks and stones." And all we did that day was to make a pile by the low wall along the road. My father used the spade to keep digging up rocks, and even though I was only 9, I noticed 2 men in the next plots talking and looking at him and laughing in a quiet way. I asked my father why, and he gave a small laugh himself and said, "The Limerick man gets the dark earth, and the man from the north gets the rocky plot." We worked till the darkness came, and we were so weak with hunger we couldn't pick up another rock. We didn't mind one bit if he carried the fork and spade and wished he could carry us too. He said we were big boys, good workers. Our mother would be proud of us. There would be tea and fried bread. And he marched ahead with his long strides till halfway home he stopped suddenly. "Your brother Michael," he said, "we promised him berries. We'll have to go back out the road to the bushes." Malachy and I complained so much that we were tired and could hardly walk another step that my father told us go home. He'd get the berries himself. I asked why couldn't he get the berries tomorrow, and he said he'd promised Michael berries for tonight, not tomorrow. And away he went with spade and fork on his shoulder. When Michael saw us, he started to cry, "Berries, berries!" He stopped when we told him, "Dad is out the road in Rossbrien getting your berries, so will you quit the crying and let us have our fried bread and tea?" We could have eaten a whole loaf between us, but my mother said, "Leave some for your father." She shook her head. "He's such a fool going all the way back there for the berries." Then she looked at Michael the way he was standing at the door looking up the lane for a sign of my father, and she shook her head in a smaller way. Soon Michael spotted my father, and he was gone up the lane calling out, "Dad, Dad, did you get the berries?" We could hear Dad. "In a minute, Michael, in a minute." He stood the spade and fork in a corner and emptied his coat pockets onto the table. "Berries," he brought, "the great black juicy berries you find at the tops and backs of bushes beyond the reach of children. Berries he plucked in the dark of Rossbrien." My mouth watered, and I asked my mother if I could have a berry, and she said, "Ask Michael, they're his." I didn't have to ask him. He handed me the biggest of the berries, the juiciest, and he handed one to Malachy. He offered berries to my mother and father, but they said no thanks. They were his berries. He offered Malik and me another berry each, and we took them. I thought if I had berries like that, I'd keep them all for myself, but Michael was different. Maybe he didn't know any better because he was 4. After that, we went to the plot every day but Sunday, and cleared it of rocks and stones till we reached the earth, and helped my father with the planting of potatoes, carrots, and cabbage. There were times we left him and roamed the road hunting for berries, and eating so many it gave us the runs. My father said in no time we'd be digging up our crop, but he wouldn't be here to do it. There was no work in Limerick, and the English were looking for people to work in their war factories. It was hard for him to think of working for the English after what they did to us, but the money was tempting, and as long as the Americans had entered the war, it was surely a just cause. He went off to England with hundreds of men and women. Most sent money home, but he spent his in the pubs of Coventry and forgot he had a family. My mother had to borrow from her own mother and ask for credit from Kathleen O'Connell's grocery shop. She had to beg for food from the St. Vincent de Paul Society or wherever she could get it. She said it would be a great relief to us and we'd be saved when the time came to dig up our spuds or carrots or lovely heads of cabbage. Oh, we'd have a right feed then, and if God was good, he might send us a nice piece of ham. And that wasn't asking too much when you lived in Limerick, the ham capital of all Ireland. The day came, and she put the new baby, Alfie, in the pram. She borrowed a coal sack from Mr. Hannah next door. "We'll fill it," she said. I carried the fork and Malachy the spade, so that he wouldn't be knocking people's eyes out with the prongs. My mother said, "Don't be swinging those tools or I'll give you a good clitter on the gob." A smack in the mouth. When we arrived at Ross Bryan, there were other women digging in the plots. If there was a man in the field, he was old and not able for the work in England. My mother said hello across the low wall to this woman and that woman, and when they didn't answer back, she said, "They must be all gone deaf with the bending over." She left Alfie in the pram outside the plot wall and told Michael mind the baby and don't be hunting for berries. Malachy and I jumped over the wall, but she had to sit on it, swing her legs over, and get down on the other side. She sat a minute and said, "There's nothing in the world like a new potato with salt and butter. I'd give me 2 eyes for it." We lifted the spade and fork and went to the plot, but for all we got there, we might as well have stayed at home. The earth was still fresh from being dug and turned over, and white worms crawled in the holes where the potatoes and carrots and heads of cabbage used to be. My mother said to me, "Is this the right plot?" "'Tis." She walked the length of it and back. The other women were busy bending over and picking things out of the ground. I could see she wanted to say something to them. But I could see also she knew it was no use. I went to pick up the spade and fork. She barked at me. "Leave them. They're no use to us now with everything gone." I wanted to say something, but her face was so white, I was afraid she'd hit me and I backed away over the wall. She came over the wall herself, sitting, swinging her legs, sitting again till Michael said, "Ma'am, can I go hunting berries?" "You can," she said. "You might as well." If Mr. Kilitree likes the story, he might make me read it to the class, and they'll roll their eyes and say, "More misery." The girls might have felt sorry for me over the bed, but that's enough, surely. If I go on writing about my miserable childhood, they'll say, "Stop, stop. Life is hard enough. We have our own troubles." So, from now on, I'll write stories about my family moving to the suburbs of Limerick, where everyone is well fed and clean from taking a bath at least once a week.